Hey, good morning.
It's a pleasure to be speaking to such an overflowing crowd today. I wanted to bring out a couple of really beautiful ideas from this week's Parsha. Unfortunately, the Pesach Rebbe did not write anything in Eish Kodesh on Parshas Bamidbar, but Rav Kook comes to the rescue. So we're going to learn through a great piece from Rav Kook together. The Medrash Rabbah, on Bamidbar, has a very interesting story that it talks about. B'shash nigla HaKadosh Baruch Hu al Har Sinai, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu revealed himself on Har Sinai, Yardo Imo Esrim Ushtayim Rivavos Shel Malachim. There were 22,000 pairs of angels that came with him, so to speak. V'hayu kulam asuyim degalim degalim. And each one had with them a flag. Okay? They each had like a banner with them. Kevan shiro osan Yisrael shehem asuyim degalim degalim. And once Bnei Yisrael saw that each one of the malachim had flags with them, hischilu misavim ledegalim. They started to crave flags. They themselves wanted flags as well. Amru, so they said, Alvai kach anu nasim degalim kamosam. We want flags like them also. So, I'm going to just skip down. So what happened? Amar lahem HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to them, Ma? What? Is avisim lasos degalim? You want degalim? Chayechem shani memalim shalosechem. So I'm going to fulfill what you want. Like it says in Tehillim, Yamalei Hashem kol mishal osecha, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu fills everything that you want. All of your requests. Miyad hodia HaKadosh Baruch Hu osam li Yisrael, ba'amar l'Moshe, and he said to Moshe Rabbeinu, Lech asel som degolim k'moshin isav. Go make for them, they should each have a flag like they crave. So, the Medrash here, when speaking about the way the flags were going to be given to Bnei Yisrael, were, in its own way, not that it needs to be alluded like that, but they were pointing out that really the Jews were split up into four camps. And the way they were split up was as follows. In the east, there were three tribes, and the flag that kind of like the flag that was the what would the right word be? The mascot flag, I guess, for that particular group was Yehuda's flag. In the south, there were another three Shvatim, and the flag for that group was Reuven. In the west, there were three other Shvatim, and that was the flag of Ephraim. And in the north, there were three more, and that was the flag of Dan. So Rav Kook looked to understand, and we're speaking about Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, the first Rav of Eretz Yisrael, of the Yeshuv, and not his son of Tzvi Yehuda, who was also noteworthy in his own right. So if Kook looked to understand what was so important about the flags of the Malachim, and why were the Jews so enamored by these flags? So if Kook explained that the flags signify a defined guiding principle. Let's take it back one step. The difference between man and Malachim is as follows. Malachim are spiritually static. There's no movement at all on a spiritual level. Man, by definition, is spiritually dynamic, meaning he can move, he can grow, go up, go down, but there's a curve on both sides which man can achieve. Each angel basically has one job with which they serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. One angel does one thing, one angel does another thing. And we see that with the malachim that came to Avraham Avinu. They each had a specific job that they were supposed to do, except for one of them. The two out of the three angels had their own specific job that they needed to let Avraham Avinu know. But each angel has their own specific tafkid in their spiritual life, whatever that means. But humans are undefined in terms of what their job is. So what happened? So Kodesh Baruch Hu gives us a Torah. And Bnei Yisrael see the Malachim coming along, coming out, shooting out on some like really hardcore metaphysical level. And the Jews envied the ability of the angels to be able to focus exclusively on their own specific character traits. And the Jews felt that if only we were able to be in touch on the deepest levels and understand what our God-given abilities are, and we would be able to utilize them in our service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and become like the paradigm, the example of what you want from us. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you created man to serve a specific purpose. And so, if we only had a bit of an inkling as to what that purpose was, we would be so much more effective in our lives. We'd be able to gear our lives towards a specific area. But we don't have that. And so the Jews were envious at that time. They were envious of the Malachim, that they knew what they had to do. And the Jews still did not. So Bnei Yisrael said, Naaseh v'nishma. A bas kol came out and said, who told you the secret that the angels use? Meaning the angels are the ones that say, Naaseh, we're going to do, and then we're going to listen. Meaning they know what their tafkid is already. Generally, humans first, before we act, we think, we strategize, we rationalize, and then we pick what our next move is going to be. An angel has no bechiras chafshi. They don't have any freedom of choice. The only meaning that an angel derives is from the act itself. Humanity, specifically here we're talking about the Jews, we derive meaning from the process, not just from the final action. So at Har Sinai, the Jewish people were enamored by the flags because at that moment of divine connection, as it were, each Jew understood their goal on a level much like the angels. But what about the flags themselves? So the Medrash teaches us that the origin of the flags go back to the sons of Yaakov Avinu. That Yaakov Avinu decided who would carry his coffin and the exact order of how he would be carried. So Yehudi, Yisachar, and Zvulun were in the east. Reuven, Shimon, and Gad were in the south. Ephraim, Manasseh, and Binyamin were in the west. And Dan, Asher, and Naphtali were in the north. So if one thinks about it, it's somewhat enigmatic.
Where did you say Ephraim and Manasseh?
Ephraim, and Manasseh, and Binyamin were in the west. So if one thinks about it, it's somewhat enigmatic that the entire origin of the flags kind of like originates with the funeral of Yaakov. So the Zohar Kadosh says, and I'll say it in English, that Yaakov represents the outside and Moshe represents the inside. That Moshe represents Torah. Yaakov represents the Jewish people, the heritage, the inheritance, Morasha Kehilas Yaakov. The way into Torah is through midos, through character refinement, through an appreciation of our tradition. That's hereditary. That's from Yaakov Avinu. We're going to switch gears for 1 second, and then we'll tie it all up. The Yalkut, which is really the Yalkut Shmoni, which is essentially an Agadic compilation on the Torah, says as follows. Now, regarding the nations of the world, we see an interesting exchange in Shir HaShirim between the Umos HaOlam and between the Jewish people. It says, Shuvi Shuvi HaShulamit, Shuvi Shuli, Shuvi Shuvi V'nechzebach. So what were the Umos HaOlam saying to the Isha Shulami, to the Jewish people? Cling to us, and we'll make you rulers. Come to the dark side, as it were, and we will give you everything you can ever wish for. So the nation of Israel, the Jewish people, reply, what greatness could you give us? Could you give us anything greater than what Hashem gave us in the desert? Can you give us anything greater than the Degalim of Yehuda, Reuven, Ephraim, and Dan? So the offers that the nations of the world throw at us are enticing, right? But the Jewish people respond with the sweet memories of the Degalim in their respective camps. I have a question. That's what you're going to remember? That's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us in the desert? I feel like the fact that he gave us the Torah in the desert is like a bit more of a momentous occasion. So where were they going with that? So what was the real invitation by the nations of the world? What they asked the Jewish people to do was to give up their distinctive look and the things that really ostracized them from the people of the world. And Rav Kook actually used the example of Gid HaNasha. The Gid HaNasha is a perfect example. Oh, it's archaic. There's no point to it. Give it up. It just creates distance. So the nations of the world logically said that without your customs, you could become one of us. But the Jews responded that these customs are deeper than just stam minhagim, than just stam customs, stam halacha. They're an outgrowth of the flags that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave to us in the desert. They're an outgrowth of our essential character. Rav Kook suggests that what is that essential character? That longing for Hashem. The longing for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The desire to be connected with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And how? How does one come close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Through Limud HaTorah. And through the performance of mitzvahs. The lovesickness that the Jewish people have towards Hashem, that is the Yerusha of Yaakov Avinu. And it stems from the flags and from the way that they were situated. And that's the reason why the death of Yaakov Avinu was so central to the idea of where the flags come from. It's almost as if Yaakov, the way he situated them, the way he set up the flags, that his tradition, his Mesorah, his Yerusha was passed on to each one of them at that time. That longing, that lovesickness to be close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that desire to want to imitate God and connect to God on the deepest of levels. It's through deep connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, through Torah and mitzvot, that we can truly allow the Or HaTorah, as Rav Kook says, to enter our lives, and mix it with the Or HaTiv'i, the natural light, that we naturally have in our souls, to bring about the uniqueness in all of us, and our ability to connect with Hashem on the deepest of levels. An amazing, amazing piece. And I think that there are really three outgrowths of that as they pertain to child, general child rearing. But more along the lines of responsibilities to our children vis-a-vis passing on the tradition itself. We can't shy away from teaching our children how to serve Hashem. And even as we grow older and may be faced with theological questions, if we allow that to influence the way we model for our children, it will confuse and disorient our children. Ignorance is bliss. And children are generally religiously ignorant. No matter how much they learn, just their sophistication, their life experiences are not enough for them to truly comprehend and appreciate the depth of Jewish theology. But as we grow older, and as we experience more, so it's not only abnormal, but it's 100% normal and appropriate to have questions, to have concerns, to have internal conflicts, both on a theological level and on a practical level. When you're younger, you keep two days of Yontif in Chutz La'aretz. As you grow older, it's tough to understand. If we don't have a Sveika Dioma anymore, how come we still have to keep 2 days of Yontif outside of Chutzlar, outside of Eretz Yisrael? Not saying that we shouldn't. And we have reasons why we should do it. But we start to think about these things. But if we let these questions, perhaps in some ways philosophical contradictions, and general theological issues impact on the way we model for our children will pick up on that. And it is essential not to allow that to impact on the way we bring our children up. And it's very easy to do it. It's very easy to do it both through negligence and through just sheer, it's not working for me, so I'm just not going to do it now. Or through questioning. Children pick up on those nuances. We've spoken about that before. Children pick up on the most minute nuances. And if we allow them to see it, it will impact in a negative direction their ability to have a healthy religious development through their adolescence. There's a second piece, and that is as follows. Now, parents need to be very careful not to contradict or undo learned lessons from school. The assumption is that we generally send our children to a school that is in line with our hashkafa, more or less. If that's true, which it is for, I would say, 99% of the people that send their children to a school of their choice, then parents must be supportive of what's taught. You can't have a teacher speak to the class about it's really not in the spirit of Shabbos to put your television on a timer. And when your child comes home, you say, that's crazy. There's nothing wrong with it. It doesn't work. Or if your child comes home and says, the school tells me that I have to wear tzitzis. But Dad, I don't see you wearing tzitzis, so should I or should I not? It's okay, I wear a talis. I don't need to wear tzitzis. You can't contradict what the school is trying to instill. If you're in line with the values of the school, if you're in line with the hashkafa of the school, then not only do you need to model that hashkafa, but you have to make every effort, concerted effort, to ensure that the children are not seeing any contradiction of the hashkafa at home, either through practice or through talk. That's very, very important, because don't forget, children spend more time in school than they do at home. And you're really giving over your children to a school in the hopes that the school will educate them both religiously and in general studies to the level that you would want to see them at. And the last piece is as follows, and I think that this is a really important piece. Just going back to the idea that each Jew not only has that Or HaTorah inside, but also that Or HaTivi mixed together, so that leaves and manifests itself in different ways for different children. So if a child is looking for a spiritual or religious outlet, it should be encouraged, it should be supported. Parents are always afraid that if my child goes too far to the right, then I'm going to lose my child. Children need to be able to experience God in their own way. They need to be able to flirt with spirituality, for lack of a better word. They need to be able to experience. They need to have the opportunities to get in touch with what makes them click on the deepest level with God. And those are things that should be encouraged. And they should not be suppressed. They're important. They're important for children. And you are bringing up children with certain, or all parents are bringing up children with certain values, certain morals, certain etiquette that we expect. So there should really not be a stira between our children finding a spiritual or religious outlet and disregarding the values and morals and etiquette that we're teaching them. They should work hand in hand. They should coincide and work well together. Okay. That is the first piece from Rav Kook. There's another very beautiful idea that I wanted to share with you. Torah says, Ve'ela Shemos b'nei Aharon HaBechor Nadav HaAvihu Eliezer V'Isamar. that these are the names of the sons of Aharon. The firstborn was Nadav and Avihu and Eliezer and Isamar. And then it says something very interesting. The next pasuk, Ela Shemos b'nei Aharon, and these are the names of the sons of Aharon, HaKohanim HaMeshuchim, the anointed Kohanim. So, what's the question? What do you think the question is? Anybody? What? Ela Shemos b'nei Aharon. You just told me who the sons of Aharon were. You just told me four of his sons. And now you're telling me that he has sons, and then he has other sons who are like anointed Kohanim. That doesn't make sense. He had sons, or he had a trillion, like he had four, or he had many. What's going on? Why are we repeating? What are we trying to say here? There's a very beautiful idea that I saw in a sefer called the Nachla Svi. And he says as follows, that the Torah is making an important distinction between the biological children of Aharon HaKohen and the spiritual children of Aharon HaKohen. As we know, when a person teaches a child Torah, they're considered a parent of that child. So Aharon HaKohen had to teach the Kohanim how to do the Avoda in the Mishkan. So through the Torah that he taught them, they were now considered his children. And so the Torah first referred to his biological children, and then it referred to B'nai Aharon HaKohanim HaMeshuchim, the anointed Kohanim that Aharon had to teach Torah to and explain to them how they should be doing Avodah in the Beis HaMikdash. Teachers are parents of our children. And this is tough to swallow sometimes. It's not fair. Teachers don't pay tuition. They don't deal with them at home. Why should they be able to get the credit for being a parent? But the truth of the matter is that they are parents, and they are parents in a very real way, on a spiritual level. And parents need to make sure, and this definitely does not apply to anybody here, but parents need to make sure that they treat, speak about, and refer to the teacher with the utmost respect in front of the child. If a parent has an issue with a specific teacher, that's a separate conversation, never in front of the child, so that the breakdown of kavod does not occur. Because what happens inevitably is that the children don't distinguish between one teacher and another teacher. They say, this is a teacher, these are how my parents feel about teachers, and they get kind of like a jaded view of how mechanchim should be treated. A teacher represents the Torah. And there's an inyan of kavod ha-Torah. Look, there. You see it with Rosh Yeshiva all the time. There are some Rosh Yeshiva that will not bend down to pick garbage up off the floor. They will not. If there's garbage in the hallway, they'll ask a Talmud to pick it up. They won't pick it up themselves. Why? I embody Torah. I cannot be mochel the kavod of Torah by bending down and picking up garbage. Okay. Then there are other people that say there is nothing holier in the world than to kind of be like machnia myself and lay myself down on the lowest possible rung to remember the fact that I'm a human being at the end of the day. And that was the whole Musar movement. They would fight. They would fight to clean the bathrooms in the Musar yeshivas. They would fight to clean the garbage. That was their whole raison d'etre. That was what they were all about. It was about getting in touch with the fact that they're humans and that they need a reality check every now and then. But it's so important for us to make sure that when speaking about teachers and speaking about Rebbeim or Morot specifically, never to do that in front of children if it's in a negative way. Because our children need to associate them with Torah, and there is an inyan of an important inyan of kavod Torah with that. Did you have a question?
No, it's just funny because I
hear
this very nice Torah once. I can't remember who said it, but like everybody, this means everybody. It's like you walk around with two things, one in each pocket.
Mm-hmm.
You should lean your
brother. Right.
And not the other.
Yes. Correct.
It applies to everybody.
Yes, they say, yes, 100%. Yeah, they say that.
That's that whole
time. Yeah, correct, 100%, 100%. They say that the Bubba Rebbe used to have that in each pocket. 100%. They say that about a lot of tzaddikim, that it was done right. No, 100%. It's the reality check is very, very important. But certainly with respect to the way that we talk to and treat teachers, it's very important for children to get that message. We don't want to break down the kavod in any way. So I had another little piece that I wanted to share with you, and it's from Psukim Hey and Vav, which are just a couple of Psukim down. Vaydaber Hashem al Moshe leimor, and Hashem spoke to Moshe saying, Hakrev es mate levi, v'hamadita oso lifnei Aharon haKohen v'shersu oso. What does that mean? That you should bring the tribe of Levi, you should bring the Shevet Levi, and you should have them stand before Aharon HaKohen, and they shall serve him. Okay. So, it would seem, that this is somewhat, I guess, it's a bit off-putting, only because our entire way of understanding the relationship between Moshe and Aharon, at least in my mind, the way I had always envisioned it in Shemos, was that Aharon was Moshe's right-hand man. Right? Isn't that how we all used to think about it? So what does it mean that the Levim will serve the Kohanim? Levim come from the line of Moshe. Kohanim come from the line of Aharon. So all of a sudden we're switching? It says in Shemos, Vayomar Hashem el Moshe, Re'enis aticha elokim lepharo, v'aharon achicha yen v'yecha. That Aharon will be your spokesman. Aharon will be your guy. You need him, he's your go-to man. He's your right-hand man. You can't do it, you're an Arel Sosayim, you're Kaved Peh, you can't speak, fine, sit down. Aaron's going to be that man for you. So how do we now understand the fact that we seem like we're totally flipping? And now when it comes time to the Avoda, so Moshe's going to serve Aaron. So I'd like to suggest the following. That Aaron's position was not to serve Moshe, per se. That he had his own tafkid. Aaron had a very real and integral tafkid to the building of Bnei Israel. And that was the unifying of the Jewish people. That was the instilling love in the Jewish people. We know Aharon HaKohen was a Rodev Shalom, Oiv Shalom, Rodev Shalom. That was who he was. He personified Shalom. He personified Ahava. He personified the Chesed. He personified the goodness in humanity. Doing everything and anything that you could possibly do to bridge people together. So his help to Moshe was only in Mitzrayim when it was necessary to achieve the common goal for Klal Yisrael. But in terms of his Avodas Hashem, it was the Kohanim and Aharon that led by example. Thus, it was the Levim who would enhance their service by accompanying them through song. So what can we learn from that? So I think that it's a very interesting phenomenon to watch 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. Particularly in middle school, you have it in 4th and 5th grade also, and less so in high school. When children are very, very young in primary grades, so unless the children are shy or whatnot, everybody kind of like meshes together. In high school, you have the clearly defined leaders. But in that like awkward early adolescent stage, kids are kind of like finding themselves. The kids who seem to have been leaders but were really bossy end up not being the leaders. And the ones that are the cool, smart kids that were quiet very often do become the lead. It's just a whole weird, nebulous dynamic where nobody really knows what's flying and things change a trillion times. But what's important always is for our children to know when to be a leader. Mishnah Avos says, "B'makom she'ein ish, When there's no person who's standing up and doing the right thing, that's when you need to stand up and do the right thing. That even with the social drama of leadership and who becomes a leader and who has those intrinsic skills, there are still leadership opportunities for our children, and they need to know, and we need to instill this in them, that being a leader doesn't only mean having followers. It doesn't only mean being the most popular. It means being able to stand up when you see something wrong and saying, this is wrong, I won't stand for it, and I'm going to make a difference, and I'm going to make a change. That's being a leader also. Being a leader is seeing somebody who needs help and running over and helping them. That's being a leader also. And we need to teach our children that. We need to teach our children that that is also a very important facet of leadership. Because what we see more and more nowadays, fortunately, is children have become very egocentric, become very focused on themselves, more so than in years past, combined with the fact that at this age, from like 6th to 9th, 10th grade, you're dealing with a community of children that, I don't mean community, demographic community, I mean like the community, a chronological community of children that are struggling themselves, that are really focusing on who they are at that time. So it's the current state of whatever it is in society that children have turned inward more and become very self-centered, and just the normal piece of that. And so what we need to do is be able to teach children. And it starts at home. Although in school, we always try to give children leadership positions, not only here, but in all schools. Student councils, GO, Big Brother, Big Sister programs, those are really, really important opportunities. But really the key is to teach children that being a leader is not only a function of being cool, of being the smartest, of being the best looking, the best dressed, the wealth. It's not about that. Being a leader means getting up and saying, I am going to make a difference. It is getting up and saying, there is no other person that's going to do this. I'm going to do it. I have a tzedakah drive that I think is important, and I'm going to push it until it's passed through. That's being a leader. And nobody else has to know about it. But I think that's a really, really important point when it comes to child rearing. It is. And it's oftentimes overlooked. You know, parents kind of want to take a step back. I don't want to meddle with my kids' social life. I don't want to get involved. It's not help. It's okay. On this level, it's okay to teach our children those appropriate social skills of leadership, of real leadership. That's what I have for today in B'Midbar. B'Midbar is kind of like a tough parsha. It's a lot of names, a lot of counting. Next week is an awesome parsha. What did you say?
I think it's my brother's parsha.
Oh, yeah, so very excited about that. But anyway, thank you so much for coming.